Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray. Hi, Fred.
Hey, Kirk. Good to hear from you. I had to hit record real quick because we're just about ready to continue a discussion. So I agree. I'm glad I did, because I think this will be an interesting discussion. And thanks for our listeners for joining us. Thanks for joining our conversation. Right. But this one actually is relevant. I think you mentioned it a few moments ago before we hit record, and it's
right.
Something that came up in a discussion with one of my clients last week. I forgot to ask him if they listened to the show. I should have done that. But is, how do you know that you've got the root cause of a problem and not just the symptom, right? And what you were talking about was you were debugging and diagnosing some electronic circuitry. And
right.
And the comment that triggered it was the same as what this client was having, is I see a burned out part on a circuit board, right?
Right.
And you go, oh, okay, that part's failed. I got to replace it. And then you realize it burns out again, or a different part burns out when you fire it up again. And that is a clue, kind of a hard way to learn it, but it's a clue right. that right. wasn't the problem. That wasn't the right. root cause. So how do you know that you've actually solved it when you're doing this root cause analysis right. or diagnostics and stuff?
And that's one of the hardest things, is isolating the root cause. I mean, when you do a troubleshooting of any system, it's a learning experience where you do rules of halves. And the way I did it, in whether it was ion implanters
What was that? Rule of halves?
Yeah, kind of a rule of halves, okay?
Half of something.
Right. Okay. So you've got this long chain of electronic, functions that ultimately, go from a voltage to an actual something of sound coming out,
an actuator kicking a motor or something
like that.
My favorite is the little green light comes on. That's my right. favorite.
So you've got this chain of things that sequence of tied together in a long chain that results in some action, some function that comes. Well, the best way you break down, since it's not working, you kind of look at the chain of from what the beginning to the end and split it into a half, sort of, and go into the middle of the system and either find out if the signals and the function that as best you can is working at that point. And it tells you which way to go. If it's not working at that point, then you go upstream. You go back farther in
the power supply kind of side.
Might be a power supply. You go back up to checking the voltages.
Right.
If the voltages are not right, you might go in and check. If you really want to go down to the component part, you might go check some of the capacitors or regulators in that mm-hmm. power supply. Mm-hmm. And once you have continued to find where it's good, and then you eventually get to where it's bad.
Now, see, that's where I think people get in trouble, though, is that you open the board and go, oh, that part's right. bad. And you see it's right. blown up, it's smoked or whatever. That's the most exactly. extreme. So I look at it as, before I do the rule of halves, this isolating right. where the issue is and where right. the trouble is go, all right, that part is damaged. And it was a comment I heard years ago from somebody said, well, was that part the instigator of destroying itself? Did it have a right. fault internally that caused it to short and flare up? Right. Or was it the victim?
Right.
Right.
Was it the right.
Right. So so this rule of halves is, if you put a new part on there, it's not, oh, I fixed it. It's
right.
Is the current coming in there as it should be? Then I start looking at, well, how much energy did it take to cause that failure, whether it's a latch up or a a wrong signal or whatever the issue is, and sometimes it blows up.
Right.
Well, how did it get enough current to actually cause that damage?
Right.
Right. Oftentimes, by simply asking that question, you know you're not looking for a bad capacitor, which it could be, right? Could be just a bad part that shorted, or it could be a bad regulator that oversourced its current to it, or it could be a short earlier in the system, a bad capacitor that shorted but could carry the current and cause the damage downstream. Part of the process is thinking through, well, what could cause this damage? And it's similar to what you're talking about. It's like, well, is it plugged in? Is the power supply working? Is this part of the circuit doing what it's supposed to be doing?
Right.
I think they're complementary, right? But I think the thought process of not where's the problem, but what could be causing this problem.
Right. Well, the difference, or one of the problems, one of the difficulties is, it's when you quickly see, you know, us experienced in burned components, immediately look at a circuit board, and if we see this, you know, the burn marks around the component, and it's obviously it's been destroyed or significantly overheated and damaged, then you're just saying, well, that's you know, it's kind of like, well, I'll just replace that. And
well, the favorite is somebody says, well, I'm going to replace the fuse with a higher rated one because obviously it was the bad fuse.
And that's certainly a terrible safety issue when you do that.
Yeah.
But our people solder a wire across. I've seen that.
Or a penny or foil.
Right. Just incredibly dangerous. But, you know, we've talked about in the past that I've worked on some pinball machines, and that was, for me, it's now a very big learning experience. But when I had the last situation, I was replacing a transistor that was burning out again because I didn't look to where that transistor was feeding its current, which was a solenoid coil that had been shorted. Mm-hmm. So it was overdrawing and burning out that transistor. Fortunately, I had two boards I could swap out and pull out, physically pull out transistors and put them in. And after I replaced all the coils.
At that point, the transistor was the victim, right? It was acting like a fuse.
And I did it twice. Because I didn't realize the coil had
been shorted. We should have had this conversation before. You know, you would have been saved lots of time. Hey, you should always talk to me.
Well, these are 30-year-old machines, and the schematics and the drawings are not all that great, and it wasn't all that helpful. So it was kind of manual learning. But this is where, again, we talk about failure being an incredibly good learning experience.
That
was very good for me. I will remember now, and no question, that the first thing I'm going to check is the end device that it goes to and see that that's not burned up or shorted like in a solenoid coil. Right. And then go back, work my way back. But, you know, it was obvious, obviously, when I looked at these are in a different physical location, too. That's one of the other problems is when you look at a circuit board, it might be in a little control box or something remote from the motor downstream that has actually, accumulated a shorting.
Some corrosion or something.
Something caused some problem. And, you know, the immediate thing is you're there and maybe the motor's 10 feet away. You first want to pull out that circuit board and replace the components because
that's where I've seen it in repair shops where they kind of get this, they get lazy is probably it's probably not the right term, but they're trying to do their job and they see part after part after part coming through or, you know, system after system coming through.
Right.
And they go, you know, 9 times out of 10, if I replace these 3 parts or these 6 parts or this circuit board or reset this part, it solves the problem. Right.
Right.
And so instead of spending the troubleshooting time to find that 1 in 10 different solution, they try the easy, the one that typically works, they just try it. And then we end up with, you know, a whole bin full of parts that have nothing wrong with them. But it's fast, right? They solve most of the problems very quickly. So it makes sense to do that.
Right. And there's that driving for fun, you know, driving goal is to get it up and running or get it repaired in a very small cycle time, because either it's cost, if it's capital equipment that's doing something, or it's a
turnaround for your customer.
Yeah, cost of repair is, you know, going to be lower if you just quickly do something.
But I think
maybe
the hard part there is that, especially in higher volume ones, is to then have a system that says, all right, we need to create a better understanding of what's going on. So some fraction of those units should go in a different path that gets detailed diagnosis first and then off the other way. The other part is when you get somebody that, I have no idea what I'm doing here. It sounds more like what yours was, this old system, and you know the electronics, you know what you're looking for and stuff, but it's that progression of how you go about, did I really solve the right problem? And one way you know is that it still fails. Like, then like you did. You're like, oh, well, that didn't work. Let me try something else. Let me keep looking.
And including the fact that I also wired something backwards, a diode I put in backwards.
Kurt, forehead slap time.
But, you know, with a second board, and these were 30-year-old transistors. So, again, there's plenty of life in electronics.
Oh, there is,
And we really don't have to worry about most of the intrinsic mechanism. But anyway, it was a, you know, this is the way, again, the strongest way of learning something. And it will save me a lot of time in the future for the next time I do this.
Well, if you're going to set out, if you were going to do this again, right, without now this knowledge of what you need to look for or solve, what would you have changed to avoid this damaging the second board? And I know that you've done plenty of failure analysis stuff around your house and sometimes, but I think the hard part here is that, just like in the repair shop, many times it's obvious. Right. This part went bad, or this got shorted by some corrosion, or, you know, the screw backed out and it did this and whatever. Sometimes it's obvious. But sometimes it's not. And that's hard to know the difference, I think.
Right. Especially in electronic components and circuitry, it is really hard to know the chain and all the devices that were connected to that could have led to the failure. But in pinball, it's always the mechanical. It's usually the mechanical components that cause a problem. And I consider a solenoid pretty much part of a mechanical plunger system.
Right.
Yeah, a small piston. So it's a mechanical. It vibrates. Eventually, it will. The insulation on the windings will break down, especially after 30 years. So that's something to be concerned with. And you can look at the outside and see that it's overheated. That's another indicator. So I've learned that too, you know, but you actually can't see a shorted coil. You actually have to put an ohm meter onto it and see a very small change from 14 ohms to 0 ohms. A good coil will be 14 ohms, a bad coil will be 0. So that's a very small difference. And, you know, once you learn that, you know what is good, bad. So that's a part of it, you know. And again, I use the old troubleshooting of transistors with just going from base to collector and emitter. And that's, you know, fundamental electronics seeing that those are not shorted. So,
Well, I'm going to go back to the coil. If it's shorted, and so the windings are not the length of wire copper that creates the 14 ohms, and it's shorted very close to the front of it, maybe a 0 or 1 ohm or milliohms. But you know, if it's shorted midway through, would it be 7 ohms, or is that?
It's a good question, Fred. I think when it happens, when the first shorting occurs, it's kind of a cascading or avalanche effect that it overheats the whole coil inside and starts. And in fact, the sleeve that the plunger actually was in had completely melted into the hole.
Oh, okay.
So I think they go catastrophically fairly quickly.
Yeah,
when they
so
happen.
You know, a big part of knowing you've got the root. The right root cause is knowing how things fail, just the failure mechanisms that you're against. And every now and then we get surprised. You know, there's new things that happen all the time, but it's but knowing what you're looking for is a piece of that. Knowing what to measure and not measure, having an array of non-destructive ways of measuring stuff, you know, ohm meter and current sensors and stuff like that for electronics. There's microscopes and visioning x-rays and stuff like that for other things. But it's
very costly, though.
Well, it can be.
It can be very costly, right.
Right. But if you were, you know, if you're working on a pinball machine and you see a solenoid that's discolored, there's that knowledge of the failure mechanism, so it's overheated.
Right.
Right. And a common failure mechanism is the windings short, and it creates that phenomenon, right? But if it's a relatively new solenoid, that would be, you know, this isn't, it could be a manufacturing defect. It could be it's got too much current. It's still, I go back to that. What could be causing this to happen? And then using that rule of half, if I have 15 ways that this solenoid could fail, I use that rule of halves idea to say, can I eliminate this group? Do I have the right current coming into the solenoid? All right, so it must be internal to the solenoid versus a victim from something else.
So I
like the approach, and I think it's even better when there's a good understanding of the
what you can
all
get,
could fail.
Right, and once you start to know a system, then you really can jump like from the middle, you know, going with the middle of the halves, rule of halves, going into the middle of it, and then going either way, downstream or upstream, based on your knowledge, you can jump pretty far to the right component. It gets better, obviously.
All right. So one of the things I commonly say when I'm talking about electronics and systems like this is that a lot of my business is generated from connectors, power supplies, and capacitors. You know, would you agree with that? If you got nothing else, blame the power supply, and if it's got software on it, you always blame the software guy,
right?
So, you know. I'm being a little facetious there, but there are common culprits that we see fail over and over and over again. And I think, like I said earlier, though, it's a double-edged sword. If you are going to blame the power supply, at least do the due diligence to, before you swap it out and create more damage downstream because it's not the problem, is at least prove that it is good or bad, you know, in some other way before you go do it.
Right. Disconnect it and measure it, you know, unload it, especially, you know, when it's, or measure it if you can and make sure that that is the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's tough to do. And, you know, you were talking about capacitors. Very difficult to find an open capacitor.
Yeah, because they're supposed to be. They're supposed to look like one.
But if they're disconnected from their actual plate, you know, positive, you know, or one side.
If it's not the solder joint problem, right? You destroy those problems. Yeah.
It's very difficult to, you know, you have to charge it up with your own meter and maybe you can get that to check that way, but
They're tough. And then oftentimes we put capacitors in parallel, which makes it even harder because they give you this average response and trying to see one that's a little different than the other ones. Yeah.
The best you can get is physical, you know, appearance.
Yeah. Look at the top.
It was blown.
Yeah. Those are happy ones when they're just, I saw one board one time, these guys, they wanted me to come help them with a failure analysis and kind of sort out what was going on. They suspected it was a capacitor on a board and they didn't have the board there. And I like, well, do you have one of these failed boards and a good board so we can take a look at it?
Yeah.
And they were looking at each other and like, should we show him? Should we not show him? Can we trust him? And I'm like, I was at HB. We're all in HB. I didn't need to sign an NDA or anything like that, but they were still very leery of showing me this. So they pull out this big old circuit board and there's a groove burned down the middle of the circuit board, about a half inch wide charred path. And I'm like,
what's that?
Would this be part of the problem? You know, it explained why they didn't have a lot of evidence, because it just fried it. So we ended up sorting that one out. And it was a cracked capacitor that went dead short and caused, just allowed this current to just fry this trace. It was a very unusual way it showed up in the failure. But yeah, it was funny. They were like, well, should we show them the carcass here? I didn't know if it was, they were embarrassed, or if they thought it was a secret that they didn't want to share anywhere else. I'm sure they're lawyers that don't tell anybody. You know, or what, I don't know. But yeah, it was like, I had to pry it out of them, and it was like, oh, that's different.
The whole chain of failure problem is, or chain of, you know, is very important in a halt test, so you stop as soon as the product fails.
Yeah, you don't want to just keep on hammering it.
Right. You know, I've had it where, you know, electronics will, the whole series circuit is just, you know, one fails and then it causes all the other ladder, the chain, to fail too, and you don't know which one was the weak link.
That's right.
Well, you know, it's very difficult.
Yeah, so you got to monitor very closely. That's probably a good subject for another discussion, is, you know, spotting those anomalies in part. And then it goes to this discussion, sort out what's going on and how deep do you need to go. So in summary, I think what I often say about, do you have the right root cause, is that you can control the failure. You're able to say, all right, if I put a bad part here, it causes that symptom we're seeing. If I, you know, it's not a hard and fast rule, because when you complicate it with, is this part of victim of something else going bad, or is it the instigator of it? Is it the culprit of it? Is kind of keep those kind of both concepts in mind. And then we've talked about a couple of ways ago about diagnosing and troubleshooting and finding where the underlying cause is. You don't need to go to the chemistry and physical, you know, material science level, unless you're the one making the solenoids. Then you want to figure out, why did this wear, and did it wear too fast, or was it nicked, or whatever. So it always depends. If you're trying to get it up and running, at least find the instigating problem, when the cause is a problem. If you're trying to design a better product, yeah, you might need to go a little deeper to understand, is it variability? Is it materials variation? Is it assembly defects? What was the deeper cause than what you had?
Yes, so, especially early in product development. And it's so critical to get that right. It's so costly if it's not.
That's it. So anyway, well, I'll let you get going here, Kirk, so you can get back to fixing something else, troubleshooting it out. Appreciate the discussion. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Fred. Good talk to you.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.